Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is April 29th, 2019, and I'm here with Samantha Sam Rickert at North Cascades National Park in, well, I guess we're in Marble Mount, Washington.
We are.
Is that where we are? Yep. In her offices at the Cultural Resources Curatorial Facility. Sam, thank you for letting me come talk to you today, take you away from your work. And this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. Before we get into you working for Klondike and Skagway, do a little bit about where you're from, how you got into this work. You said you came from Wisconsin originally?
Oh, well, I went, my undergraduate degree was in political science and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin. Okay. I grew up in St. Louis and then went to school at University of Wisconsin, and I stayed there for 5 or 6 years after I graduated and worked in natural foods co-ops. And then I decided to move to Seattle, and I worked in natural foods co-ops there. And then I went to school, like a little independent film school, and because I wanted to be a filmmaker. And that was an interesting and challenging period of my life where I was not making very much money and kind of having a blast. But anyway, I met my partner Rick, and he is 20 years older than I am, and so I decided to go back to school, and I went to I was interested in public history originally, and because I like the documentary side of filmmaking, and I just kind of happened into the open house for museum studies. There are museology program is what they call it.
At University of Washington?
University of Washington, Seattle. And I got my master's degree in museology and started working for the Park Service in the regional office as a student. And then when I graduated, they converted me into a term. And my boss at the time, I was all funded, all my work was funded on soft project money, PMIS projects. And so my boss at the time was like, this fund source is getting collapsed. The money for these projects is drying up. You need to get a permanent position somewhere. And so I started looking for permanent positions, and the Klondike one came open, and Teresa hired me, Teresa Thibault, and I headed up there.
And that was in what year?
That was February of 2011.
February, good time to arrive in Skagway. Huh?
It was horrible. Yeah, I mean, you know, all the people in the regional office were like, oh, you know, Southeast Alaska is the banana belt, and it's going to be totally warm up there. Don't worry about it. And then we were taking the Alaska ferry on, you know, yeah, in the first week of February, and it was miserable cold and just really kind of bleak.
Yeah, those winds coming off the glaciers in Skagway in the winter are brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been there in December and it was pretty cold.
Compared to Seattle, definitely a big change.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so when you got to Skagway, what was your job? What were you?
So I was a museum curator. I was in charge of, we just started the exhibit planning for the visitor center, new exhibits for the visitor center, and that was I think the first week that I was there. Started sitting in meetings for that and learning the museum collection. I was supervised at Betcher, a museum technician who had been there for a long time, and everything that museum program management entails.
So how do you learn about a collection being new and there's all this stuff, and how do you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, it helps a lot that Deb was there, because she was just kind of like the brain of the collection. I mean, she's been there for so long, and so you just kind of start, you know, going to the facilities and seeing what's there. I remember walking into the what we call the SSB, the stuff storage building, which is like the main purpose built collection facility that was mostly, it was actually built to be cold storage for archaeology collections, because that collection was stored at the, well, at, when I was there, it was stored in the Mascot building on the second floor. And I feel like it was stored someplace else before, but Deb would know. And so originally they had were building that cold storage building for the archaeology. And then I can't say that we received the Rapuzzi collection, because it was more that the park entered into agreement to process the Rapuzzi collection with the city of Skagway. But that building had, so they put HVAC in that would control, you know, like it made it a really nice facility. It wasn't just cold storage. Mm-hmm. It had total HVAC controls. And then they put the history collection in there. Really, it was just the Rapuzzi collection at first. And then later we started kind of migrating some other history stuff in there. But it was, yeah. So I just remember walking into that building and just seeing all this stuff from the Rapuzzi collection and these creepy mannequins that Martin Itchen had made. And kind of just being like, you know, what did I get myself in for? This, I don't even know what to do with this stuff. So
because it wasn't really organized.
Well, I mean, it was organized. I mean, it was on shelves. It wasn't just a big pile of stuff. I mean, but it was just, those mannequins are just really creepy. And I mean, they aren't creepy to me anymore. Right. Now I made friends with them. But at the time, like walking into a cold was just like, man, there's a lot of stuff in here. And what is it all? And so you just, I mean, it, you know, I would say that it took probably a good year to feel like I had a handle on what was in the collection exactly. But, mm-hmm. you know, because Deb was there, that wasn't really an impediment because she just facilitated the whole program.
So what types of things are in the collection? I mean, you said there's a history collection. Oh. What's that?
Oh, okay. Well, in Skagway, that is largely materials from the Klondike Gold Rush or shortly thereafter. And so one of the things that I did when I was there was work on the scope of collection statement to try and tighten that up so we really knew what we were collecting. So we weren't just collecting stuff that was cool. We were collecting things that actually had to do with the park's enabling legislation and the purpose of the park existing. And generally, because there's so many buildings in the park, I had to establish a period of significance for each building. And so, you know, it didn't mean that we wouldn't have stuff like from the 40s necessarily, but it had to do with the particular history of that building. Generally, we didn't end up really collecting anything past, I would say, 1920. So really like 1890 to 1920 was kind of our window.
Mm-hmm. And then there's archaeology.
There's archaeology. So those are mandated collections. So that's anything that the archaeologists dig up. And one of the issues that happened was there's different interpretations of what that means. So nowadays, a lot of archaeologists will collect representative samples. Mm-hmm. Like if there's a whole bunch of bricks, like you don't need to keep all of those bricks. You can keep one or two of them. Teresa was a very old school archaeologist, and so she really thought that we should collect 100% of everything, which meant there were like gum wrappers and things like that in the collection. And Deb Sanders had fought really hard to be able to deaccession some of that stuff. It wasn't so much of an issue when I was there, and I think part of that is that the frontline archaeologists were a little more sensible about what was important to collect.
And was archaeology still going on under some of the buildings when you were there?
There's always, every year there was compliance archaeology happening, and I'm trying to think of what some of the projects were. Let's see. So, you know, when I was there, that was when we were stabilizing Sophie's, or Jessamine's Parlor Museum. So when the building was jacked up and there was active work on that landscape, then the archaeologists were monitoring and they were also doing some test units, as I recall. And then I think they were also doing some things at the Fry Bruin building, which had basically been moved over behind the Moore House.
Oh, right. Okay.
So there was, because, and it's all kind of in preparation. I think that, as I recall, there was so much going on at that park. But as I recall, the Fry Bruin was just kind of jacked up on blocks.
It still is.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. And so they were doing some stuff over there to kind of prepare for getting it off the blocks, I think. I mean, I wasn't 100% on what the museum program was really busy, so I wasn't always paying total attention to what the archaeologists were doing. Right. But
and now, why was the museum program so busy? I mean, such a small park.
Well, the Rapuzzi collection was enormous. Right. And so we had, I would get questions like that, like, well, do you guys take the winter off? Because there's nobody there. And it's like, oh my God, there's so much work to do. So we were doing exhibit planning for the visitor center. That took forever. I mean, it was going on. Actually, I have to take it back. We were doing the exhibit planning for Soapies when I was there, when I first arrived. And the visitor center stuff started later. I just remember sitting in these exhibit meetings and they kind of blend together in my mind. But no. It was so really like the Soapies project was like the total arc of my time there. Like when I first showed up, that was when we started doing the exhibit planning. And then when I left, we were getting ready to install. And then I went back after I'd come to North Cascades, I went back to help complete the installation.
You left in 2015?
Mm-hmm, July 2015, I came down to North Cascades.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think of when I went back to install. I want to say that fall, maybe? It could have been either the fall or the spring. I don't quite remember.
I think most people don't realize that curatorial and museum collection work goes on.
Oh.
In a national park, they think of, in a museum or something.
Right.
And so that it's interesting that, how busy you can become.
Oh, yeah. Well, so the Rapuzzi collection, I don't remember the numbers. I think originally they thought it was something like 150,000 objects, and then it got scaled back to something like 30,000. And it's kind of hard to say, like, and then there was actual inventory numbers that I think were more like at 10,000. A lot of things were lot cataloged, like here's a big bucket of nails. And so to kind of rewind on what the Rapuzzi collection is, that is, so George Rapuzzi lived in Skagway from 1898 to 1987, I think. He spent his whole life there. He worked for the railroad. He was, I would say, a hoarder. So that was the thing with this collection, is there was a whole bunch of, and there was a period, and this is, I didn't live there, but my understanding is there was a period before the park was enabled where all these buildings were kind of falling down and abandoned. And so he would go in there and he would take stuff, for which later we are grateful, because that meant that a lot of these things got preserved. But he'd also, there wasn't a broken chair that he didn't like. And so part of that collection was just sorting out that there was all this stuff. And so some of it was total gems and some of it was kind of cool and some of it was just garbage. And so, it was really hard. Like the acquisition happened before I was there, but there was an appraiser that came out, at least this is what the records show, and that was what they, made the offer based on. And the Rasmussen Foundation helped, they basically purchased the collection and then donated it to the city of Skagway because the MPS couldn't, Teresa Thibault would have liked for the MPS to just take on that whole collection. But Stephanie Stevens, who was a regional curator at the time, stepped in and said, no, you can't do that because there's so much stuff in this collection that does not have to do with your park's purpose. And it is past the scope of, so the scope of collection statement became very important. And this wasn't before I updated it. It was still pretty loose in a lot of ways. But it was clear that, so much of this material was past the scope of collection. And so what they worked out is for the city of Skagway to take it on, and then they would transfer, the two curators would started out being Debbie Sanders and Judy
Munn.
Yes, Judy Munns, thank you. Basically, they kind of developed the sorting process where you would, it's either park or it's city or it's other. And then part of what my job was, because I was there near the end of the sorting, was to figure out what do we do with other. And you cannot underestimate like what an enormous amount of material this was, and that you couldn't just, like a lot of times with a museum, the standard in museum collections is, you know, you don't separate out a collection. You want to keep it all together. But there was just no way you could do that. It would be onerous. And there was a lot of, you know.
Well, and if there's two chairs that are exactly the same.
Right.
Then couldn't the city museum have one and the park have the other?
Well, and that happened a lot. But, you know, honestly, these weren't like those broken chairs. It wasn't like they had any particular, I mean, there was like, gosh, there must have been 40 or 50 of them. And there was certainly furniture that we kept. And furniture is a bulky thing to have in a museum collection. But there was just, I mean, they were just like regular old chairs. Like, there wasn't anything special about a lot of that stuff. It was just, it was more that, like, kind of Alaska / Depression era / poverty mentality of, like, you don't want to throw it away because you might be able to fix it. And George Rapuzzi was a fixer guy, but there's sort of this point where it's like you just can't fix everything. I mean, I think that, like, there was, I think that Edna Rapuzzi had something like 10 sewing machines, because it's like, I mean, there was just, there was hoarding happening It was past the point of reasonableness. And, you know, like the basement of the Rapuzzi house, I was not there when they pulled that out, but there's pictures in the collection of Deb in full hazmat gear because it was just moldy and awful. And there was all that stuff down in there.
And he had it in multiple buildings as well, right? Mm-hmm. I think he owned the buildings, or I don't know how he...
So the buildings also came as part of the collection. And so, and those got split up. So the Park Service took Jeff Smith's parlor and the Fifth Avenue buildings, which is like the YMCA and Brown Shoe Store and Myers Meat Market. And the Fifth Avenue buildings had a direct link to that.
And those
Klondike Gold Rush era.
They are the YMCA, that building, they are currently restoring.
Mm-hmm. Well, it, you know, it's a little deceptive because it's like they're kind of all, I mean, we talk about them in terms of being separate buildings and maybe they were built, but they're really just like one big building that's kind of been.
Well, they call it the YMCA Meyer building, I think, or something.
Yeah,
but
something
anyway,
like
that one, at least that part, I don't know about the other part, but there's a project going on there right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I worked on some of the exhibit planning, very early exhibit planning for that. I mean, some of the discussions were that should be, because there's so much material, you know, should that be more space? So when I was there, Mike Tranel was the superintendent, and it was his favorite topic to talk about reorganization of spaces. And, you know, part of it was that the Rangers were unhappy with what they had, which is kind of legit because they just had like this little tiny,
it was their offices, you mean?
Like, yeah, their offices.
Main
and
building.
It started out that they were in what they called the Cribs, which was like old prostitution buildings that were right off of Broadway. And then the second half of the time I was there, they were down in the basement of the Pantheon. Or, I mean, not the basement, but the first floor. Mm-hmm. There was just always discussion about space and moving things around. And so the YMCA, we spent a lot of time talking about what that should be. And should it be a collection storage facility, or should it be offices? And there was some time that we spent talking about that there would be kind of like a, the front part would be kind of like a place where people could, like a little reception area, and then the museum program and probably also archaeology would be in the behind that, and that would be like kind of our offices, and we would sort of be available to the public. And then the middle one, I think the Meyer Meat Market, like that was going to be kind of like a library where people could access, because part of the concern was that there wasn't like a reference area or where people could access oral histories and things like that. So that was supposed to be kind of like a reference area. And then the YMCA itself would be exhibits. But then there was some discussion about, oh, well, maybe there needs to be more. I mean, it just changed kind of all the time. It was always supposed to be something to do with the Rapuzzi collection, because that building or building complex had been acquired as part of the Rapuzzi collection. And I think Teresa in particular had a lot of, it was supposed to be one thing. And part of the reason, when I say one thing, I'm kind of it's sort of like there's so much stuff happening all the time there in that job, and it was a really high profile museum collection, at least in terms of the town really cared about it. There's a lot of you know, because there's so much tourism in Skagway, there's a lot of opportunities to make it available, and visitation is really, you know, it's a cultural resources park. So the cultural resources are front and center, and the museum collection of all of those resources is super front and center, along with the historic buildings. And because, you know, the museum collections are so tied with the historic buildings, that it just really is so, it was so different from my job now. Like, my job now, working for a natural history park, I manage scientific specimens and park records, and the superintendent has been in here twice in the three, almost 4 years I've been here. And when I worked at Klondike Gold Rush, it was like I was always, it felt like I was in the superintendent's office like once a week. And there's all this exhibit planning and all this space planning stuff happening. And then there's also this really complex relationship with the city of Skagway and with, and working with Judy, and like, that was really a hard community relationship to manage. Not because I got along with Judy really well, although we butted heads sometimes, but, you know, she was, I mean, she never wanted that collection. It was thrust on her. And it was, there was just a lot of complicated relationships, and she was getting pressure from the city. The city was very hands-on. I mean, in terms of like the mayor and the city council, everybody had opinions about that because they were all really invested in what was happening in the Rapuzzi collection. And then there was also different opinions of like, this is just a bunch of junk. I can't believe you're spending all this time on it. Or all these things are perfect treasures. I can't believe you'd want to get rid of any of it. And we were just kind of in the middle trying to walk the path between, you know, trying to figure out like, what can we legitimately take care of? That's always huge for museum collections, is like, what can you actually take care of? Because it's very expensive to curate something, and you have to have it in, especially in the Park Service, where we have a lot of standards.
Climate control.
Yeah, you have to have climate control, and you need to maintain inventory. And so there's a lot of duties that managing an object as a museum object entails. So
and that community pressure, often people in the community, as you say, they're very attached and invested, and George Rapuzzi was very important to the community.
Yeah,
probably lots of people knew him and he lived there a long time, but they don't have that professional training. They don't understand
right
what a museum specialist actually does.
Right. So you're always trying to educate people about what that means. And then one of the things that also is that is creating access for people. If you don't create access for people, they really won't understand what you're doing. And Debbie Sanders, who was the curator before me, was not particularly interested in creating access for people. And this was, because I remember when I first started working and I was like, oh yeah, anybody can have a tour of the collections. I'll totally. And Deb was beside herself because she was like, well, you know, if you're going to give that person a tour of the collections, then you have to give everybody a tour of the collections. And I was like, is there a problem with that? And she just said, well, you know, I mean, it really had been a dynamic that only special people got to tour the collections, which to my mind, as a Park Service curator, it's like we manage things for the American people. And they are the people's things. And so anybody should be able to come in and see things. And that is not, that's the old school of Park Service curators that came up in like the 70s, or like, I don't know, 70s, but like the 80s and 90s, that was not their attitude. And I had the same thing here. You know, like there were signs on the door that like, basically, this building is alarmed, do not come in. And nobody, I mean, I work with people here that have they've worked for the park for 15 years and they've never been inside this building. So, you know, my attitude was that that needed to change and that it needed to be available to people. And if there was one time, you know, where it's just a bunch of guys that had been drinking coffee and they wanted to see the pistol that had been in the wall of the YMCA. And so I gave them a tour, you know, and was like, okay, well, let's do this. And that wasn't always, you know, a lot of curators wouldn't do that. So,
but I agree with you that the way to educate people about what's in a collection and why it's important is for them to see some of those gems.
Right.
You don't necessarily going to show them the bags of wood chips, but maybe you do.
Well, maybe, you know, I mean, that's the thing is, like, maybe they need to see that stuff because they need to understand what it is we're doing. And, you know, not, I mean, there's definitely stories about people messing with archaeologists in Skagway and putting things in pits for them to find and stuff like that. I can't think of any specific examples. But, you know, there is a tension in Skagway between the railroad families. Like, a lot of them have been there since the gold rush, and they'd worked for White Pass and Yukon Route, and they, you know, they were traditional Alaskan families. And then there was the Park Service people that showed up to work for the park, and, you know, there was always a little controversy about hiring positions from out of town. Like, my position was a good job in Skagway with benefits and year-round employment, which is really hard for people to find, and why are you hiring somebody from outside of Skagway to come and do that, you know, because we've got people here that need those jobs. So there's always some tension about that, and then also, you know, feeling that the park is overstepping it. You know, I mean, there's a classic in Alaska is that the federal government is always overstepping its bounds, and what do you think you're doing? And so, you know, and then the park people tend to be a little more politically progressive. And so, anyway, it seemed like there was kind of like, you know, the old town people that had been there, their families had been there for a few generations now. And then there was the park people. And then there was, like, kind of the people that were making their money off of tourism. So kind of like, and one thing about Skagway is there's naked capitalism there in a way that I have never seen anywhere else. Like, I lived in pretty progressive places, right? Wisconsin is full of co-ops, and, you know, it's not about capitalism. It's, like, full of farmers and co-ops and stuff. And Seattle is very progressive. And even, you know, like, people that I knew that I thought of as being kind of, I mean, they were just there to make money, you know, and so they had a different way of thinking about things that I wasn't used to.
Yeah, certain the summer tourist businesses, and they're there just for the season. They don't even live there.
Yeah, right.
They're all about there to make money and leave.
Well, that's one way of looking at it, but, I mean, yeah, and there certainly are a bunch of seasonal people that, but there's also people that are seasonal that just, they don't have necessarily the money to leave. They've decided to live there year round, and finding a year round job for them is kind of amazing. And one of the ways that I was able to, quite frankly, capitalize that on that for the museum program is that that was how we were able to get volunteers to help us, is that we could offer free housing because the seasonal workers for the park weren't using it in the winter. And so if somebody needed, you know, housing is just a horrible issue there. And so, so we were able to offer winter housing for volunteers. So Tekla Helgeson was one of the volunteers who I was able to get her some internship money. And she helped us when we had to move the Rapuzzi collection. So the Alaskan building was a building where a lot of it was being processed. And we were leasing that from Phyllis, who was...
Phyllis Brown.
And then the lease came up, and it was decided that we should get out of that building. And so we moved a whole bunch of stuff. And mostly what it was housing at by that time was either things that the city had claimed or things that were in the other category that were going to need to be disposed of in some way in the future. And so why was the park paying all this money to rent this building? And so, although, I mean, I think... Oh, yeah, and that's another thing, is that this building had been, the rent was supposed to be split, but the park had never bothered to bill the city for their share of it, and so it had been paying for it, and there was, like, politics there, and also some incompetence on the part of the park, and so basically, like, we had shouldered, I think, the rent for several years, and then the lease was coming up, and there was just kind of like this, there was always everything about that collection, there was always some complicating factor. Like, oh, and by the way, you never bothered to build a city. And so people in the park are all angry that the city hasn't paid their rent. But, oh, by the way, you've never actually bothered to build them. And so how are you expecting to receive that money? And then, anyway, so... And then, you know, different fiscal year cycles and, you know, money was obligated, but then it went away because it didn't get used. And so anyway, the point is that Tekla was a champ and helped us move all of that stuff in the winter, you know, to these storage units on the edge of town. And, you know, we're wearing headlamps because it's like dark at 3 o'clock and it's icy and miserable. And we were moving this stuff and it was...
It sounds like the Rapuzzi collection, there was a lot of moving.
Yeah.
It went from his buildings to this building to that building.
Right. Yeah. You had to get it out of the original buildings. And part of that was because in the case of Soapy's and YMCA, the park was actively stabilizing those buildings. So everything, and they were condemned. I mean, they were going to fall down. So it's like you got to get the building completely clear so you can jack it up and lay a foundation and then bring it back down and then start to do the work. And then we ended up putting a lot of material in the commissary, which I feel kind of bad about because that also needed that work to happen, but the city was not on top of it in the way that the Park Service was. And so we knew that that building needed care, but we didn't really have any place to put this other stuff. And so a lot of things got put into the commissary. And
was the commissary building, was that a World War II commissary?
Yeah, it's the one that's right next to Soapy's.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's the World War II commissary. And that one was claimed by the city, and they were going to do, like, some kind of exhibit about World War II in Skagway.
Yeah, I don't know that that's happened.
I don't know.
Well, you were talking about the volunteers. So you were getting volunteers from outside. Like, you know, you said Tekla was a student intern or something. What about the community members? Were they ever interested in being volunteers?
So I would actually kind of qualify Tekla as a community volunteer because she didn't have any prior affiliation to the park. She wanted to work for the park, but she was like a tour guide.
Okay, so she had been in Skagway.
She had been in Skagway for several years.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Okay, I was thinking when you said, well, she needed housing, it made it sound like she was coming from outside.
No, but that's the thing with the seasonal community there, is that a lot of times your housing is, they're really transient within the boundaries of Skagway, because sometimes your housing is, you know, like your housing is provided by the people that you work for in the summer, but then when that job is done, where are you going to stay? And so you're looking for some other place to stay, and then if you can volunteer, that's free. And yeah, I mean, it's been... there was one woman, Gina, who had worked for the park, and she volunteered. I can't remember if she volunteered for one or two winters with us. So she had park housing in the summer, and then she would volunteer in the winter, and that way she'd have a place to stay. I'm trying to think of other community volunteers.
But some of those longtime railroad family people, none of them ever came and volunteered.
I feel like there might have been one, but not general. It wasn't like we had a huge bucket of volunteers. One of the things that stands in the way of that is that the because of the security protocols for the Park Service on internet, you know, it's like the museum work always requires using a computer, and you have to go through this whole background check to get that done. And by the, you know, and it's hard to ask people to do that because they're kind of like, well, why don't you just trust me? And it's like, well, it's not me, it's the federal government. And
could you fill out all this paperwork? Even volunteers have to go through that whole
thing. Unless they're not going to work on computers, in which case they're not very helpful as a museum volunteer. I probably could have done more to ask, but really what I needed help with was stuff that involved computers, you know,
just
so
entering things in a database and things like that.
Yeah,
I know with the Park Service, you all have your little card that you stick into your computer.
Right.
You can't do things outside of work hours and all that stuff.
Yeah. Although, one thing that we did that was really fun, that was like a very short-term volunteering thing, is we had all this stuff in the World War II commissary, like all these mechanical things, because George Rapuzzi was a mechanic, and so there was just a lot of mechanical stuff in the collection, and so Deb would identify things as best she could, but there was always some things that she couldn't identify, and so we had these object ID days where we would just... We laid out things on the table. We got donuts and cookies, and we laid out all this stuff on the table, and we advertised it to guys, basically, mechanical kind of guys, because there were all these machinists that worked for the railroads. Right. They were really great. They were a great asset. And so they came in, and basically, when we just followed them around and took notes furiously, and they told us what they thought different things were. And we did have... trying to remember names. So there's Jimmy, I can't remember his name, but he was an engineer, and he would come and help with identifying things sometimes. And then I can't remember his name. He lived across the street. Joanna's his Andrew Byerly, who used to work for the Park Service, and he would come over and help identify things, and we, you know, they were, he was a great resource. Both he and Jimmy were really good resources. So I wouldn't say that we didn't have any volunteers out of the community, but they weren't what you classically think of as a museum volunteer who's like coming in and helping.
Well, object ID day, the object ID day sounds like a great idea.
Oh, it was super fun. It was one of the funnest things I've ever done, in, at least in the museum world, because it was just, those guys are great, and they're just, you know, machine oil all over their hands, and they're eating these donuts and talking, and they were just really having a good time. So
now, is there ever with the museum collection, like that machine stuff, I assume it wasn't operational anymore, or was some of it operational?
Well, it's kind of like define operational. I mean, there's, you know, it's a lot of pieces and parts, and so they could be operational.
Because I'm wondering, is like, is there any ever a time that you might say, oh, we want this to work again, here you guys are machinists, here, could put it back together for us? Does that ever happen?
Well,
I mean, there's restoration of, you know, old steam engines and things, but I don't know if in Skagway there was anything like that.
That was an issue that I had to deal with as a curator, particularly in regard to the mannequins and in regard to the streetcar. And for Park Service standards, you would not want these things to run. Teresa really wanted the mannequins to be operational.
Because they were like automaton kind of
automatons,
things?
Automatons, right. We call them mannequins, but they're really automatons. And so originally they were hooked into Jeff Smith's parlor, the building structure, and there were these pipes and pulleys and things, and Martin Itchen would get them to move as he did his tour, and we spent a lot of time trying to figure out like what exactly they did, and like including having them x-rayed at the clinic, and have and having different conservators look at them. And I had I ran a conservation program in the summer. I would, for 3 years, I had interns come, and they would do all the conservation work on the items that were going to go back on exhibit at in Jeff Smith's parlor, and then some other things too. And so they definitely worked on all of those mannequins. And so there was three. So there was Soapy, and there was Dangerous Dan McGrew, and there was Lady Lou. And Soapy had already had work done at the Alaska State Museum. And this conservation program happened because Scott Carley was the Alaska State... Well, there's two museum curators, conservators for the Alaska State Museums, and one with his wife Ellen, who did the in-house work in Juneau. And Scott was a conservator by training, and I think he was actually called, I don't remember, but he was basically like a staff curator that went around to different museums.
Yeah, they had a museum support program that helped small museums around the state.
Yeah, and so he came. I called Teresa, really wanted these. That was the first thing that happened, is you know, we were having these exhibit meetings, and Teresa was like, I really think these mannequins need to work. And everything I'd ever learned about museums was like, that's a bad idea. And so, and I had written my thesis about aviation museums. And so that issue of like whether something should fly or not fly, work or not work, it definitely was salient for me. But you could look at them and tell that they weren't going to hold up to anything. They were really, I mean, he just built them out of, literally out of like old pieces of wood and string and chunks of leather and whatever. Like they weren't going to be that. And so I called Scott Carley. I had heard that I could get a free conservation assessment from him, and I asked him to come and look at them and basically be the expert to tell her that that wasn't going to fly. And so... there was a lot of different discussions about maybe we could have a hologram of them that we could play in the museum, or maybe we should have a replica that could be activated. Like, what is more important? Is it, you know, and there's a lot of discussion about the concept of authenticity, which to me is a very negotiable concept. It's like, what does that really mean? For Teresa, it was a much more hard and fast thing. Like, she wanted this museum to be totally authentic, whatever that means. And so, you know, we should take the original wall coverings and we should put those back up, and we should take these mannequins and we should have them operational. And we were all just kind of, you know, we're just sort of operating on these different pictures that were taken of the museum at the time. And it changed. You know, there was a certain point where I had to kind of put together a timeline, and we had to decide on what period of the museum are we actually restoring to, because things kept changing over time, because this guy's tourist place and he's moving stuff around and doing things.
Exhibits, you know, change in many museums.
Yeah, well, it's a little different. I mean, you know, there's a whole thing of exhibit planning.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Martin Itchen isn't planning, he's just moving. He gets stuff and he puts it up and he moves it around and he makes something new. And you know, I really you had respect for, I had respect for that he was an inventor and a creative person, but he was more of an artist, a folk artist than, I mean, he was a folk artist. So,
yeah. Well, that's the idea of authenticity, and what do you restore to time-wise? That's the issue for the historic buildings too, I think.
Absolutely.
They had to
pick
a time period.
Yeah.
And so for the Jeff Smith Parlor, what was your decision for, did you come up with a time frame?
We did. I can't remember the exact year, but there was a point where, and one of the things is they wanted George Rapuzzi to be part of that story, that they, pretty much Teresa was running that thing. Originally, Debbie thought it would just be like Martin Itchen's, like there, we had early pictures of that museum from the 30s where it didn't have anything in it really. You know, like the mannequins were in it, but that was pretty much it. And so Debbie had like not collected every single thing that was shown in some of the later pictures. And there was some negotiation that happened with the Skagway Museum to get those few things. Because I think we decided on like it's been a while since I thought about this, so I think it was like 1963. There was a point where George Rapuzzi had taken ownership because Martin Itchen had passed away, and then they moved that building from, it used to be on off Broadway, I think, and then we had pictures of it getting moved in the 60s, and then George and Edna decorated it, and we had like in a, there were some like things in old newspapers about, you know, advertising that it was now open. And I want to say that it was 1963. So there's a very short period where, you know, it was moved to the current spot that it was in now. And George and Edna had decorated it, and then it was open. And then I think that only was really open for like a couple years, and then it became open only by tour required. Like you could make an appointment with George Rapuzzi and see it. And he was kind of paranoid. And so there was also correspondence about how, I mean, I think that there was a cruise ship that offered to buy it, but then I don't know. There was something where like George Rapuzzi got really paranoid that everybody was going to come and want to take all this stuff. And so you could kind of, the later stories from like the late 60s and early 70s or that if people made friends with George Rapuzzi, he would offer to take you on a tour, but it wasn't just open to the public, you know? So there's that little open to the public window that we wanted.
So that early 1960s is what it's sort of...
Yeah.
I would have thought you would have done it too when Martin Itchen was using it as his museum.
Well, a lot of that decision-making was driven by Teresa Thibault and that she really wanted it to have the Rapuzzi that... She didn't want to erase that part of the story. And I don't have an opinion on this one way or another, but the thought process was they didn't want to erase the Rapuzzi part of the story. And so, also, you know, there's all this stuff. I mean, when Martin Itchen had it, there wasn't as much stuff in there. And then, you know, there's all this really cool artifacts that we could put in if we wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, people would never see them.
Yeah.
So.
I kind of lost track of where we were. The conservation...
Oh, you were talking... We were talking about whether to run things or not. And I
want
to circle back to that because of the streetcar issues. Because people really, really wanted to... People, at least a few people, especially, I want to say, Steve... He runs the Skagway Streetcar Company.
Oh, yeah, Heights.
Steve Heights. And I don't know if anybody else actually thought it was important that the streetcar run in the 4th of July parade, but there was a lot of pressure to do that. And again, I had conservators come out and look at it. I had money for a conservation assessment, and they were basically like, that's not a good idea.
Because, yeah, so the Martin Itchen streetcar was part of the Rapuzzi collection.
Mm-hmm, right.
Now is in the park collection.
Right.
And that's from what time period?
It was the 1930s. It's a 1908 Packard chassis that he then took. We had pictures of a horse-drawn carriage, and he took the carriage part and put it on the back of the chassis to make kind of a cabin for passengers. Mm-hmm. And then the engine was like a later model. Oh, I can't remember.
I've seen pictures of his old streetcars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he had several. So this is the only surviving one, and it was the first one. And it was, so it had a later engine, not the 1908 Packard engine. And the conservators looked, so basically we had money first for a conservation assessment and then to try to restore it. And again, it was like, you know, Steve Heights was like, oh, well, you know, in the 70s, we used to always run this in the 4th of July parade. So why can't we do that now? And we're kind of like, well, because it's a Park Service museum object now. And also these conservators say that it's not particularly stable and we don't really, you know, it's like, and it's that thing of like, it's the original fabric of this. So like, how much work do you want to do on an engine to get it running? And is it that original artifact anymore? And I just was really uncomfortable with the whole thing, especially because it had like these old tires on it. And so we did, I don't think it was for the 4th of July. I think it was for some other, but basically we had, because we were moving out of the Alaskan, we needed to move it to, we ended up moving it to a garage of a house that the park owned and used for seasonal housing. I want to say it was like down on 15th or something. So this was so stressful. Luckily, I had this really great conservation intern, Nicole Peters, who was there for 2 years. And the second summer that she was there, she also cleaned all of the taxidermy that's in, I mean, like those big double stuffed moose that were in Jeff Smith's parlor. She spent a whole summer suiting up in Tyvek and cleaning that with a tiny little conservation vacuum thing to remove the asbestos from them. I mean, the asbestos isn't totally removed, but all the loose stuff has been vacuumed up. Anyway, she was there and we basically attached the streetcar to, we tried a couple different things because at first we were going to try to put it up on a trailer and that totally wasn't working. It was, I can't remember exactly, but it was definitely not working. And so we had these little electrical truck car things, like they're like golf carts basically that the park uses to zip around in downtown Skagway.
Yeah, maintenance guys use that. Use those.
Yeah. So maintenance was enormously helpful during all of this, and so we hooked that up. We hooked up the streetcar, got it out of the Alaskan garage where it had been for a very long time, and then took it downtown so people could, you know, take pictures and stuff. We parked it in front of Soapy's and people had their picture taken there. And we parked it across the street from the visitor center and people had their picture taken there. And Steve Kites came over and knocked on it and was like, "This old girl," and I kind of wanted to slap him, but it was okay. We just moved along. And then we finally took it down the road. And it, like, as we were doing that, as we were, you know, rolling it down towards 15th, the tires started to come apart. So we got it in place, but it was very clear that, like, yeah, you're not running this in any parade. Like, this thing is very fragile. And so it's hard for people to understand that a vehicle can be fragile, but it was helpful, always helpful to have conservators come and look at these things and kind of back you up, you know? So it wasn't just my opinion. It was like, oh, I have this expert opinion, you know, even though I could have told you that myself. But right. Yeah.
So these, like the conservation intern you mentioned, Nicole, was she a University of Washington student?
No, she came from? So she actually was, she had gotten her, conservators have a very long road for getting their degrees. And so she was, she had gotten, I can't remember where she went to school, but she had gotten a Master of Fine Arts in Ceramics. And at the same time she was doing that, she was also taking organic chemistry and other prerequisites for a Master's in Conservation. And then she had done, already done like a few internships for under conservators. And then she came out the first year and, and then worked under Scott. I mean, so Scott was my partner in all of this. Like, basically, like, I supervised the conservators, the conservation interns day to day, and, you know, gave them objects to work on and signed off on the work. But Scott would come out with them and kind of set them up and look over the objects they were going to work on and kind of talk to them, talk it over with them. And then he would also make like a midsummer trip and kind of just check up on them. And so, yeah, they couldn't, without his oversight, we would not have been able to have that project, that program, but it was really great. And he did it for free. He didn't get anything out of it. He just did it because he cared about training the next generation of conservators.
Yeah, I was wondering where people who get training in conservation get their education.
There's only 4 programs in the country. And Nicole did 2 summers with us, and then she went to the, while she was trying to get in, like that first summer she didn't get in, just barely. And then next summer after she, I can't remember what she did in the winter after she, that first internship, but then she came back for another summer, and then she was accepted to University of, it was Buffalo.
SUNY Buffalo?
Yes, SUNY Buffalo. So they have one, there's one in Delaware, there's one in UCLA that's through the Getty. And there's another one that I can't remember the name of.
Yeah, it's very specialized.
It's very competitive, very specialized, and I mean, it was like, it was tough for her. Well, and then she got into like all the programs that she applied to that second go around because she'd had so many internships. It was, I mean, Scott was basically like, if they, if you don't get in, you're just gonna have to be a conservator on your own because you've got so much experience. You know, but she really wanted the degree.
Yeah. So. Well, so that internship program, was that something you started with
the
park? Yeah,
Scott and I started it.
And so how was that funded?
It was funded through CCM money, Cultural Cyclic Maintenance. And Teresa had put in for, we knew that we were going to need conservation work done on these objects. And so she had put in for 3 years of funding, and I was left to manage that as a best. I mean, it was really like the project statements were very nondescript. And so I had a lot of leeway to use that money as I saw fit. So,
So how do you decide what objects needed to be conserved?
Well, we prioritized what was going to go on display. And then the paper was a big issue because that was, you know, so originally the interior walls were covered with historic newspapers and little flyers and whatever Martin wanted to put up there. And that itself probably would have been enough without even, if they wanted to take it back to the 30s, that would have been fine because there's so much to look at on those and those historic newspapers. So originally the plan was to put the historic newspapers back up, but they were in terrible condition. And
I can't imagine pulling them off the walls and having them still be in any useful condition.
Well, they were all adhered to kind of a base of like an underlying cardboardy kind of stuff. And so it was just like these big chunks that were kind of all glued together. So so the first thing, there was a conservator whose name I cannot remember, who had done the work on the Moore House. And so I contacted her and asked her if she was interested in doing this work. And she came out we hired her an intern, Quinn Ferris. You can tell I have a lot more relationship with the interns than I was supervising them and I spent all summer with them. So, so they worked on the stuff and it was very, very slow and it was really fragile by the time they got done. And she was just like, you're just not going to be able to do that. And that was really, actually what was really fortunate is that Teresa left. And so I had a lot more leeway on what decisions I could make because that focus on, oh, it has to be the original thing. It doesn't matter whether it's going to damage that original thing, that I was relieved of that. And so I went ahead and contracted with Harper's Ferry to clean and stabilize. And then I'm trying to remember who made, I had to go through the government printing office to have the reproductions made. And that was kind of a debacle because like they just hired whoever was cheapest because it's a government printing office. And it turned out okay in the end, but luckily they sent a proof and we were like, no, that sucks.
So they were printing reproductions of these newspapers?
So the newspapers, or wall coverings really, I think is what we call them, they all went to Harper's Ferry to be cleaned and stabilized as best they could be. And then they went to this contractor that the GPO provided, and they printed out reproductions for us. And that's what's installed on the walls now.
Okay. And are the originals still in the collection?
Yeah. Yeah.
They were conserved enough that they're not falling apart.
Yeah. I mean, if you leave something, a piece of paper flat in housing, it's fine. You know, it's just a matter of if you put it up on the wall and, subject it to a whole bunch of UV light because you're in a building that's open to the public and then people wandering through with pollutants and everything. No. Yeah, they're in there, and they should be fairly stable.
But it was important enough to have the representation of them that's why you made the reproductions.
Oh, I think that's, the most important thing. I mean, that's what gives you at least a feel for the character of the building when Martin, made that. It was a lot of historic newspapers, and they were all digitized, too, I think. I'm pretty sure. And so that was some of it is there's also historical information available there, right? So they're a resource on a number of levels. Mm-hmm. So we wanted all of that. Yeah.
I've sort of lost track of where we were going. you mentioned that working with Teresa. Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about that? Are you comfortable talking about that?
I can talk about that. She had a reputation for being very persnickety, and also maybe not particularly rational. The first year that I worked for her, I really thought she was, would publicly humiliate me in meetings, would be, she was just really, I really thought that she was going to fire me. I like you have a 1-year probation when you come into a permanent park service mm-hmm. position. And I went in for that. And I would cry in the office. Like Deb would, I just remember this one time just like breaking down crying in front of Deb and was just like, I don't know what I'm doing here, or what's going to happen. And I went in for my evaluation and she's like, oh, you're doing great. And then after that, she just completely left me alone. Mostly, except for every once in a while, she would kind of check in on the project. And it was always rough to have her come by the spaces where we were processing collections, because she was one of those people that thought that nothing should ever be thrown away. And so that made it difficult, because we're like, well, we can't keep everything, you know. But she would just be like, oh, this is so important, and this is really great. And so it was like, try to keep her out of collection spaces as much as possible. And then the issues of, you know, authenticity and that I've already spoken about, right. Those gave me a lot of headaches. And so it was a relief when she was off of that project. And I have to say, I felt kind of bad. I mean, it was like, you know, we installed Jeff Smith's Parlor, and I feel like there's a lot of issues with, you can't get very many people through there. Like, it's so full of artifacts. I mean, it's very cool, and then it's full of artifacts. And we really, I went with the direction that the park management gave me, and that we were trying to make as authentic a reproduction as possible. But there was not a lot of, I think, my perception is that during that decision-making process, they did not spend very much time thinking about how that was going to actually play out with people actually going through this when you have 10,000 people dumping off of cruise ships, but maybe 15 people can fit into the space at one time. So it's a really different space than like the Mascot, where people can kind of wander in and go to the bathroom, you know? And the look on the face, I can't remember that, like when I was there, there was a new interpretation chief. It was Cindy Von Holly the whole time during the exhibit planning. And she was really hands off about it because she was on the verge of retirement. And I kind of think she just was like, I'm going to leave this problem for the next person. Like, because nobody wanted to fight with Teresa because she could be really mean. Yeah. And so there was a lot of dynamics down the hallways of headquarters between different chiefs. And in a small park, you know, everybody's like packed in together there. And so I just remember, I think it was Ben was the new chief of interpretation and just showed up and like, here's this real challenge in terms of creating public access to this museum space. And he was not a very happy camper with what had been dealt there. Because there wasn't even really, you know, I mean, just, we put in some railings around the mannequins. But, you know, anytime that there's, we're really counting on people to keep their hands to themselves. There's so much fur in there and people really want to touch that. You know, like there's this like stuffed dog that people could totally run their hands up and down if they wanted to. Yeah, so we didn't really do the interpreters any favors. I don't know how that's going.
Yeah, I don't know. But, yeah. And we should say that Teresa was the head of resources.
Right,
right.
She was head of resources.
So mm-hmm. she oversaw the curatorial staff and the historian and the natural resources program.
And most, I think, importantly, she oversaw the archaeologist, because we had a really hard time keeping an archaeologist because she was so... Like, once I was in place and she kind of decided that I could be left alone, she went back to making the archaeologist miserable. And there was a guy who, I can't remember his name, David, I think, who was hired in as the permanent archaeologist. And I watched her not help him at all. And he was brand new to the Park Service. So there was just this huge learning curve for him to understand the bureaucracy and what was supposed to happen. And she fired him. She did what I thought was going to happen to me, is that she fired him within the first year. And it was really a travesty. And that was when people kind of showed up out of the community and were like, is there anything we can do about this? And we all kind of had to say, not really, because Park Service, you know, career Park Service people are fairly protected. Because he'd moved there with like his wife and two kids, and his wife couldn't find a job because it's Skagway and it's a small town. And so she was staying. So they were completely dependent on his income, and there he ended up like having to move back in with, I think they moved in with her parents, and his career was kind of ruined. But luckily she had such a reputation that there were archaeologists that had reached out to him and said, oh, I heard what happened to you, do you need a job, you know? And she, you know, it all came down to that we were supposed to give her these bi-weekly reports, which she obviously never read, because you'd say, well, I wrote about that in my bi-weekly report, and she'd be like, oh, I don't know, you know, okay. And it's like, yeah, so she fired him on the basis that he was not sufficiently producing these bi-weekly reports, and it was unclear whether she had ever even told him what she expected out of them, and it was just, and we just saw her badger. I mean, you look through the records of the archaeology collection, and you can see, you know, just this rotating door of people coming in and out. And Sean Jones survived all of it only because he was just so meek that he just would kind of like huddle down and protect himself. And somehow he lasted long enough that he was able to finally get permanent. So.
And why was somebody like her allowed to stay in her position and be such a bully that how come she wasn't moved on?
Well, that all sits on the superintendents and what their decision making. And I know I had a discussion with Elaine Furbish after the thing happened to David, and she just said that she had been the natural resource, and this is all completely hearsay, but that she had been the natural history or the natural resources person when Teresa came on, and that it was clear that she was going to be a problem, and that Elaine was like, I don't know that Elaine was let go. I mean, I think she resigned, but like, you know, she was just basically like, I can't deal with this. And that her feeling was that the superintendent had hired Teresa and really was invested in seeing her succeed, ironically. And, so yeah. So it was really, you know, and I mean, there's a chief of one of the divisions in this park that really should not be in a position of leadership, and he's still here, you know? And so I feel like that is one of the things that is very difficult working for the Park Service, is that we don't seem to be able to figure out how to deal with people that are toxic in our organization.
Mm-hmm.
If they're at a higher level, right. You know, if they're, you know, seasonal, like whatever, but if they're at a higher level.
And did a staff report complain about Teresa to higher ups? Were they aware? Was the leadership aware of the situation?
Well, I think there was awareness. I don't know. I had never complained to higher-ups because she left me alone. But when she left, all of the resource people went into Mike, Superintendent Trunnell's office, and said, we want to have some say in who is going to replace her. And it was very clear that he knew that she was, a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And her departure was, she chose to move on to something
She did.
Else.
She took a job for the Forest Service.
Right.
Yeah. She had wanted to be superintendent, and that was part of it. I mean, so she had, and that was part of the thing that was hard too, is that she had these antagonistic relationships towards the superintendents, because she, for at least the two that I was aware of, she had applied for their jobs and then didn't get it, and so then was really antagonistic towards the people that were hired for that job. So, and I think she just finally got tired of, like, she really was ambitious and she really wanted to move up, and she wasn't making that happen. And so she went, then this job opened up in the Forest Service, and her partner works for the Forest Service, and she just decided to bag out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I totally forgot the question I was just going to ask. I know what it was. You're talking about, you know, coming into a position that, so did you say Deb Boettcher had been working with the museum collections for years, and you came in as a new person.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a difficult transition?
It was. I mean, yes and no. I mean, I really relied on Deb, and she's such a hard worker. And we had some conflicts during, I mean, she has a strong personality and we certainly had some conflicts when we were working together, but overall I look back on that experience and I just, I wish I would have been a little more gentle on some things. Because it hurt, you know, really, of all the people that have worked with that collection, she's the one that's been the most dedicated. So, mm-hmm. But she definitely had opinions on how things were supposed to be. And the part of that was grown on the way things were before. And so, like, when I first started working, she would occasionally call Deb Sanders and be like, is it okay that Samantha is doing this? Because she didn't really trust my leadership. And so that's hard when you're a younger person who's a little unproven. And then, mm-hmm. you know, like, you're... person that you're supervising is like, I don't really think you're doing the right,
right.
thing.
Well, that's what I was worried yeah. is, you know, you're, yeah. you're the new person coming in,
right.
someone who's been there a long time, that can right. often be difficult.
Yeah, it was, but we worked it out. I mean, I think that we had a really good working relationship while I was there mm-hmm. overall. So it had its ups and downs. And part of being in a small town like Skagway is that you're in community with people, you know. So I would see Deb outside of work, and I always enjoyed seeing her outside of work, and I consider her a friend. Mm-hmm. But like here, the people I work with, I don't really. I mean, one like the fire management people, a couple of them work down or live down the road from me. But it's just not. Skagway is just really like it's very social and it's very community oriented, and you see people, you know, like you can't mm-hmm. just go. Be reclusive on your, you know, little farm out in the country or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you said yeah. that was challenging for you in the community. Yeah.
I'm not an extrovert. I'm lucky that I'm married to an extrovert. So he built a lot of our, I would come home and just be so fried from, I'm an introvert and I would just be so fried from negotiating all the relationships at work all day that I would not want to talk to anybody else. And he went out into the community and he would go to these coffee clutches that happened in the mornings in the coffee shop. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. And, yeah, so he networked into the community for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, you had said earlier that living in Skagway was not always easy for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, yeah, I mean, there was that part of that I'm not a totally social person, and I was negotiating a lot of relationships. You know, it is really important. I mean, the person that I first started working for in the regional office in Seattle, Kirsty Hartel, said that when a GS, being a GS9 is about achieving your skill level, but being a GS11 is about maintaining relationships. And that was a lot of my job, was like, you know, I had a relationship with Judy Munns. I had a relationship with Johnny Powell, the chief of maintenance, is like, you know, navigating with my boss, navigating with the superintendent, trying to keep on good relationships with everybody else in the park. It's a lot. So I didn't really want to talk to anybody when I got home. And I also don't drink, and like, that is, when you are in an Alaska, a small Alaskan town, that's really hard, because it's like, you don't want to go out and be part of nightlife, because people really drink there, you know? Even like a book club, it was like, the main reason of the book club was so people could knock back multiple glasses of wine, and it's just like, so I ended up, I went to the birding group, and there was a knitting group that started, I went to the knitting group, and, that was pretty much my social outlets, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were people able to separate, you know, okay, maybe you had a meeting with some people, you know, and you were there being the park person doing your job, but then away from the job, were people able to separate you and that you were Samantha and you're a person, or were you always having to deal with, oh, you're a parkie, you're a parkie?
Well, I mean, in the places that I actually ended up socializing, it really was not an issue. I mean, the knitters didn't care.
Yeah.
And the birders, half of them worked for the park anyway. So, you know, I ended up socializing a lot more with park people than I did with non-park people. But I didn't really have a lot of social life, honestly, there.
But even like, you know, if you would go to the grocery store or the post office and you'd see people... Were people friendly, or they're like, oh, you're the one who wants to throw away the Rapuzzi chairs?
Oh, no. People were always friendly. Yeah. it was very rare that somebody was unfriendly to me.
So people didn't hold a grudge and...
No. And
because I can imagine it being very stressful.
Well, that would have been really stressful. That didn't happen. I don't think it was important enough to people to, you know, there's a few people that were. But, you know, one of the things that I really value about Skagway is that, and I don't see it here, in the place where I live now, if you are conservative or progressive, like, people don't interact. And one of the things I really valued and loved about Skagway was everybody had this attitude of like you were all in it together. And it reminded me of when I lived in Wisconsin, and I think part of it has to do with the weather. It's like you don't know when somebody's going to come. You're going to need help getting your car started or getting pulled out of a ditch or whatever. And like people could very civilly agree to disagree. And that was, you know, that was something that my partner, Rick, really liked about it too. He would go to the conservative coffee klatch and he would go to the left wing coffee klatch and everybody just, you got along and you talked to people and you always waved at other people. And there, I never felt that tension, which I do. I've gotten like shade thrown at me going to the dump because it's obvious, like with the bumper stickers on the back of my truck and stuff, that I'm not a Trump supporter. Right. And like, you know, and I've kind of had like side eye from other people in the dump, but you never experience that in Skagway. Like people are really very civil with each other. And I really, yeah, I really valued that.
Yeah. Cause I know, you know, you were talking about the park community relationships and, you know, I've heard stories about when the park first started, you know, there was a lot of animosity and negative feelings. And so I was wondering by the mid-2000s when you were there, if that was still going on, if you felt any of that.
I did not feel that. And I started to really, I mean, you would kind of hear criticisms of the park, but what you heard a lot more was people starting to recognize that because the economy had so much shifted to tourism and even the railroad was dependent on tourism, people recognized that the park had done a lot to make that town someplace wanted the people wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And so even if they didn't always agree, I think there was, for sure, from the people that were operating tourist businesses, and from, you know, I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time in the parts of the community that were maybe less favorable towards, but I have definitely heard people say, you know, without the park here, we wouldn't have all this tourism and these businesses wouldn't exist. And so we better appreciate that that has happened here, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did talk about the visitor center exhibits, because you just talked a lot about the Jeff Smith part. Yeah. You worked on the visitor center exhibits
as well? I did, yeah. Well, let's see. So that project was, it was, the funding came from, I think somebody sued the Park Service for not being, not providing for disability access. And so then there was money that was allocated towards starting to make all of the parks exhibits in all the parks, you know, universal accessibility. And we got pilot funding, and so the one that our park was supposed to be kind of like one of the first examples, mm-hmm. you know, so that was built into the project from the start. It, because of the high profile of that, it was all run through Harper's Ferry Center. So it was, yeah, it got a little complicated because it's like, okay, the contracting officer is, and you know, and then there was like a few other people from Harper's Ferry Center that all participated in, and they were all keeping an eye on this universal design aspect. And then there's the contractors, and then there's the basically the park people are kind of like, we're providing the resources, like we're helping them figure out what, you know, what the story is and what the objects are, and here's our space and this is what we can do. So that felt like a much more straight ahead, because it was a more straight ahead kind of exhibit design.
So what was the exhibit like before?
Oh, well, I mean, there's a guy, like a mannequin, not an automaton, it didn't move, who is, it was sort of a representation of a ton of goods. And so he, you know, he's got, I don't think there was a sled dog there. I think he's just like him And he had this fur hat that we ended up having. I think the fur hat was stolen once, and so then they got a replica, and I think they pasted it to his head. And there's just all these boxes that represent, you know, the ton of goods. And then there's a few cases in the other room that were, that had some of the objects from, they were all from the Chilkoot Trail. Because those were, that was, that exhibit was put in like right when the park was started. And so there wasn't even very much stuff in the museum collection at the time. And so it was, you know, I think there was like a dog saddle and a mining pan and I don't know. And then like the world's tiniest type. It was definitely not universal design. It was really outdated looking. And then we had a rotating exhibit that we, like there was a case, also not very universal design. It was like an old jewelry case. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful piece of furniture. Really nice wood with this glass top. And we would, you know, so that was part of the job there too, is like doing these rotating exhibits every year, different things.
So the previous visitor center exhibit, was it in the same space that mm-hmm. it's currently in?
Yeah. Yeah. That bottom of the, oh, and then there's the vault. So yeah, it's like the bottom of the Railroad Administration Building, which is also the Park Administration Building. Right. And then there's the vault on the bottom, and that was, had like bars of something painted gold and I think a scale or something like that.
So when you're doing this exhibit design, I'm curious how that works between the role of you as a curator versus somebody who's an exhibit designer versus someone who's an interpretation person. Mm-hmm. What are your different roles in that? Because it sounds like you all work together.
Yeah, we did. So their job is to figure out, you know, like we're providing them with the story and the objects that we think might help tell that story. And it was kind of hard because they were like, well, can you just, you know, typically this happens. People are like, can you just send us pictures of everything? And we're like, no, because we don't have pictures of everything. So they came in and they did a tour and I kind of walked them through objects and they took some pictures on their own, you know. And I think we went back and took better pictures later once they'd kind of honed it down to what they thought they might use. And there were definitely some objects that we advocate for because we think they're really cool and we kind of like for you to use it or we think it's got an important part of the story. And then you know, they kind of come back to us with like, well, here's a script of what we, you know, how we think we might tell this story. And then we kind of say, well, we know, maybe that's not accurate, or maybe you're highlighting this too much and not as much this. And mostly it was about like, to start out with, they'd have, so we kind of give them all the stuff, you know, like we kind of give them all this information, like here's the story and here's the resources and you kind of go away and come up with something. And then they came up with three different scenarios, and one of them was about, I can't even remember exactly what they were about, but they're like, one of them focused more on people, you know, specific characters, and one of them focused more on choices, like if you were trying to do the Chilkoot Trail, you know, here's some of the thing, you know, like they, I think they had, it was kind of like a game, gaming stuff is really big now in exhibit design. So it was like, you know, sort of like it's a roll of the dice if you go this way or that way or whatever. And I can't remember what the other one was.
Well, you said about, you know, you picking objects to tell the story.
Yeah.
Who decides what the story is? That the interpretation staff, the historian, I mean, as a curator, how do you guide the story?
No, I don't guide the story. I mean, there's sort of an established history there, right? So there's, I don't really recall what material, I wasn't part of coming up with the material to give them to learn about what the Klondike Gold Rush mm-hmm. was.
But so it was these outside exhibit designers who were sort of going to write the script?
Yeah, well, so they do like, so the way this happens is we have a workshop. And so you give them a bunch of material ahead of time, and they should be kind of familiar with, you know, what the history of the Klondike Gold Rush is.
Right.
And then they come and they visit, and we kind of walk them through what all the resources are and talk to them about, you just talk to them about the park and, you know, what the resources in the park are. And somehow they take all, and somehow they take that all away and they come back with the script.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then interpretation staff they're not doing the exhibit designing, they're doing the...
They're probably, everybody was participating in those workshops, but probably they're talking more about, this is what we do right now, and this is how we're going to staff this program, and this is, you know, you're supposed to have a long-range interpretive plan, and so you have themes set out that you are trying to teach the public about, and so I don't know if we had that or not, but most certainly the interpretive themes were discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because you'd think you'd want the exhibits to mesh with those interpretive themes.
Right. You definitely want that. But part of what you're also talking about, I think where the interpreters were really helpful in those processes, is really thinking how people are going to move through this space. This is how people interact with this building, and this is how people, you know, like, because, like, establishing the path that people are supposed to move through, mm-hmm. or like, you know, and giving them a reality check of like, okay, yeah, there are mornings where there are 10,000 people that dump out under our doors. So, you know, what does it mean if you have a sound exhibit? Like, what if if you're playing audio in this one corner and you've got like 50 people in the room, like, is that even worthwhile? And thinking through things like that.
Yeah, or that every time somebody walks by, this sound is going to go off. And if you're the staff person in there, is that if there's 10,000 people?
Right. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. So yeah. I think they're really helpful in helping them get a real picture about how.
And you said for the Jeff Smith parlor that thinking about the human flow didn't happen.
No, it really didn't. I mean, there was some discussion. The exhibit design people that we contracted with for that, they were... So... That was really illuminating to go through that visitor center process, because that is not the process that happened for Jeff Smith's parlor. Because instead of that, you know, like, so it's like the flow with the visitor center was like, okay, they come and we do this workshop and they kind of take all this information away, and then they come back with some ideas and we tell them what we like or we don't like, and then they go away again and they come back with some more, and there's sort of this like, you know, phase one schematic and phase two schematic, and sort of there's this refining process, and then they manufacture it and install it. Whereas, you know, Teresa's attitude was, well, we have to do some exhibit planning because it is an exhibit, but we already know what we're doing, and so therefore we don't really need that much from you. And so it was a very slimmed down contract for the exhibit planning, and a lot of the things that they, you know, I mean, they definitely, the exhibit planners definitely said, you know, it's going to be a lot of people in that room. But that just came down to, well, maybe we can move the bar back 11 inches. Okay, will Deb be able to fit behind there to clean, or some other, you know, museum technician who comes behind her? Will people be able to fit behind there? And like, it's like little micro decisions rather than coming at it from this sort of like raw material thing going into a refinement.
Mm-hmm.
Process. So yeah,
and I have heard that at some point they sort of did like a sign up in advance, get a ticket thing for entry into the parlor. I don't know if they're still doing that.
I don't know.
You know it's like going into some museum where you can only have so many people in at a time, so you go, you get a ticket, show up at 1 o'clock, you know, and then those people go through. And
yeah, you'd have to, because you couldn't just have anybody show up there.
Yeah.
You know, like, you have to control the flow of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was the thing, is that Cindy was just really like, well, the person who comes behind me will figure this out. Like, she was not very involved in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the use of objects in those exhibits, you say the designers say, well, we want this or that. I mean, not all objects can go on exhibit.
Right.
So how are those decisions made?
Well, you pick objects that are going to illustrate the story that you're trying to tell. And then there's always a little tension there that sometimes you don't have the object that's going to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
But in something like the Visitor Center exhibit, they don't care about that so much. Like, they're not very object-focused exhibits anyway. So if you have an object, it's kind of like, you know, a little extra icing on the cake. It's not integral. They're just not like a... what you think of as a traditional museum exhibit. I mean, Park Service Visitor Center exhibits, it's like they're supposed to last 20 to 30 years. You need to think about the objects going on exhibit, that they might be on exhibit for 20 to 30 years, so you can't pick things that are light sensitive or, you know, very fragile. So, but objects are just not a central part of that. I think that we kind of pushed on them that we, because we had such a big museum collection that we really were like, we want to use objects in this, but ultimately, you know, I don't think it really used that many objects.
Does it use photographs a lot?
I mean, I think so, because, I mean, I don't really recall.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, you know, my memory of museology is you don't want too much text.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't going to stop and read it.
Right.
So objects would be better because they, you know.
Well, we
especially those people going through that visitor center, they're not there for very long.
They're definitely, you know, we have a big, Klondike has a big historical photograph collection, and it definitely got a lot of use when I was there. And it was,
So anyway, I find it interesting that it's not as object-oriented of an exhibit.
Well, I do think that they, I mean, I think you're right that they used a lot of photos. But, you know, there's also things like, I mean, I can't remember exactly. I kind of haven't thought about it for a while, so I don't really
remember. I haven't been into that exhibit recently, so I don't know what's in there.
Yeah.
But I was thinking if there's some object, like your newspapers is a good example, that if there's some object that is determined to be critical to telling the story, but is one that can't go out on exhibit, then a replica gets made. Is that the way to sort of solve that?
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to solve it. Yeah.
And then what if you do if you don't have the object in your collection?
Well, you can't put it on display then.
Yeah. They have to change the story.
No, they don't have to change the story, but you can't use an object to illustrate that. You know, I mean, there was things, I mean, I don't know what ended up happening, but one thing that they talked about was that there was going to be like a boat with like video of going down the Klondike River, or is it the Klondike River? You know, the river that goes into the Klondike coal fields. So, you know, it's like they're, that kind of exhibit is more about trying to give you an experience than it is about trying to show you an object. So, yeah.
And the trends in exhibit design change through time.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. I mean, so that's a, So, you know, something like Desmos Parlor that was put together in the 30s, although not by a professional exhibit person, but, you know, that's all about showing stuff, or that's like in the 60s. And that's about, you know, really showing a collection, not necessarily a museum collection at the time, but showing a collection. And I think the kind of exhibit that they were doing was more about kind of like what you see at science centers and things like that. Like, we were trying to tell you a story, and here's ways to help you think about what it would be like to be a person in that story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I, even as a museum curator, it's like, I definitely appreciate that objects are an important part of storytelling. And one object I would like to talk about in regard to that, which I think that they put in the collection, but I'm not 100% sure, is that there was a horse skull still with a bridle on it that had been collected from, it was in the Rapuzzi collection. George Rapuzzi had gone and picked it off of White Pass Trail. And when I was there, there was really no discussion about all of the animals that died on that trail and mm-hmm. what that really meant. And so I pushed hard to have that included, to have some discussion about, you know, that this animal cruelty had happened and was an important part of the story. Because there was a lot of, you know, people just want to talk about like plucky stampeders and it's all cool. And it's like, let's also talk, you know, and there was also discussion about, you know, they were trying to be sensitive to the native history of the area as well. And so talking about all these people show up completely upend the native way of life. They're like killing all these animals in cruel ways by not, you know, not feeding, like bringing them and using them as pack animals and then like not even providing for their food. And let's talk about that as well, that this is part of this historical event. So that was probably the contribution I felt best about to that mm-hmm. process.
And then you also mentioned that there were rotating exhibits.
Right.
How were those decided on and put together? What were some of those themes? Well, they
pretty much just came out of the museum. Now, let's see. So so Deb and I would just kind of come up with ideas and, mm-hmm. and then execute. So, and so I think I also had some interns working on things too. But so I did one on historical photography, or, you know, like the history of photography, because we had all these different types of photos in the collection. And so, and some cool cameras and stuff, as I recall. And I think the one that had been done before I got there was called What's It? It was just like weird little objects from the Rapuzzi collection, and people could guess what they were. And we did a natural history one year, because we had, you know, we just took objects out of the natural history collection and put those in. Yeah, so there was usually some pretty, it was fun to do those little exhibits.
Well, it's interesting cool. that you as the curatorial staff chose those themes and selected the objects and put those together, that it wasn't, you know, interpretation or exhibit designers, that role fell upon you guys. I don't know if that's typical.
Yeah. I think that varies. It just sort of depends on what kind of park it is and what they, but I mean, interpretive staff would have to, well, one thing is, you know, you had to do that work before it was the season. And so that work needs to happen in the winter and spring, you know, and then install it. And we knew what was in the collection. And so it's not, I mean, it's, in some ways it's not so great, because it, you know, it's like, it's very hokey and piecemeal looking. Like, we did our best to make nice captions and stuff, but they'll always look homemade mm-hmm. at a certain level. And that's not what interpreters want to see, but people seem to like it, and so we continued doing it. You know, I mean, it was definitely an expectation of the job mm-hmm. that we would continue to do that. And then also we did window displays too in the front of that window. Usually that was like bottles and metal things, because those are things that we didn't have to worry about getting hit with a bunch of light.
Right.
Yeah.
And what about the mascot? That has exhibits in it too, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Those are completely static exhibits. So there, that was, besides Deb cleaning it a lot in the summer, it's pretty low maintenance.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was wondering, is about, you know, do you inventory what's there, you clean it, you...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Pantheon, does that have exhibits?
Well, partway through when I was there, that turned into the Junior Ranger Center. And mm-hmm. then there was a case that we put stuff in. We tried to put in things that we, like toys, basically, like historical toys,
mm-hmm.
kid stuff. Yeah.
And then now there's the... It's where you go get your trail permit, the Wilderness Center kind of concept. I can't remember what it's called.
Right.
And I think it has a little, you know, display in the front window.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's Park Collections or if that's Parks Canada stuff.
It's not. It's if it's the same stuff that was there. So we, I'm trying to remember. We made this tent. Like, we had Cy helped. And Cy Dennis. Mm-hmm. And then Elaine's buddy, who had he sewed sails, and so he had this industrial machine that would sew mm-hmm. canvas. And I can see his face. He's got a great beard, but I cannot remember his name. But anyway, he let us use his canvas. Or maybe it was kind of also Elaine's machine. But anyway, there was access to a canvas sewing machine, so we made this little tent. And we put it in and that was for the admin building displays. And then we'd like populated it with, you know, stuff that Stampeders would have had at their tent. So then when that was not going to be needed anymore, the Wilderness Center took that. And then I think we had accumulated a certain amount of stuff from the Rapuzzi collection that was what we called educational collection, that was not part of the museum collection. But could be used for props and displays and stuff like that. And I think they probably have some of that stuff to make their little front display.
Mm-hmm. So for people who don't know museums, educational collections are what you use to demonstrate for school groups and things like that. Things people can touch. And
right. Things that you don't care about, basically, like it's props that are around. And maybe they're historical, but it doesn't matter because you've got another one in the collection. So basically it's things that are designated for consumptive use.
And in Skagway, was there education activities with kids or school programs?
All through the interpretive division, yeah, there was, I don't know, school programs. I mean, I think I had maybe some classes come through. I think once or twice we had classes come through for a tour. I can remember doing that at least once, maybe twice. And then there's like Junior Ranger Day and stuff like that. But all that's pretty much run through the... And there's Ranger Teacher Ranger, that program, where there's, I don't know, it's a, I think they run kind of like a summer camp. I don't know.
But I'd say the interp staff use that stuff for their walking tours, their public programs.
Yeah, things like that.
Things like mm-hmm. that. Okay. And we've been talking all about museum objects, mm-hmm. but that collection also includes paper and photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that considered an archive then?
Yes.
And so how is that managed?
As best we can. There's definitely, Debbie Sanders had put everything into record groups, and I don't know if we want to get into the weeds on this, but part of my training is, I focused when I was in school on archives as well as museum collections, and so I was trying to get it, I found it really hard to find things. Deb found it easy, because she knew the system really well, but to my mind it wasn't standard archival arrangement, and so we were working on integrating, and then all the guidance came out. There was a push in the Park Service to there was a big backlog of archives in the Park Service. There still is, but in around 2010 or so, there was what we called the flexible base funding for organizing archives across the Park Service. And there started to be more guidance on how to approach that. And there was a senior archivist, John Roberts, who would look at your proposed arrangement and kind of give you feedback and stuff. And so I wrote to him and he gave us some advice. And so we started working on kind of sorting from the record groups into a more traditional archival arrangement. And I don't know what kind of progress happened there or not. I mean, we were kind of part way along when I left, so we'll see.
Because managing an archives and the arranging of those kinds of collections, it's a different system than when you're organizing an object collection?
Right. So objects, you really think about just the individual object. And that's, it's like, and when you are, you know, when you're taking care of archives and records, you're thinking about the assemblage of information and how does that make sense. So what you see a lot traditionally in the Park Service is like these, like there's a file folder and it's individually cataloged with this like catalog number, and it's like it doesn't really help you figure out how that fits into the overall arrangement of information that in the records that you hold, and it makes it hard to find things. So the traditional principle is to organize by it's like a French phrase. It's basically
provenance. No.
Basically, it means that you keep the order that it came in. You organize it by who the record creator is, and so what had happened at Klondike, it was mostly sorted by subject matter, but that made for some really weird record groups because like. Debbie had started it for each building, and so like you would have the archaeology and the stabilization and then whatever kind of dumped into this record group for like the mascot or whatever. And that was kind of okay because you kind of, there's not crazy amount of records there, but then there was just this lump sum category called Klondike Gold Rush, you know, record group 5, I think, Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. And it was like, everything was just dumped in there, and it was dumped in there in the order that it came in. So like you're going from central files to interpretive stuff to, you know, it was just kind of like, it felt to me very random. I mean, Deb, because she has sort of this encyclopedic brain, was like, it's fine, I can find everything. And I was like, that's fine as long as you're here. But when you're not here, you know, how are people going to find stuff? And so, and I'm kind of dealing with the same thing here at this park. So it's not an unknown phenomenon. And part of there's history there, which is that the Park Service originally was told that they should not be in charge of archives. And so museum curators came across, and there wasn't any way. Now we have an archives module in the museum database, ICMS, that's set up to process archives in a fairly traditional fashion. But before that was established, it was the only thing that was available for was for you to catalog it as an artifact. And so, and there was instruction from DC that said catalog it as an artifact because otherwise you have no business dealing with it. So, and that, you know, that all goes back to like relationships between NARA and the Park Service. And then, you know, back in the day, we used to have secretaries that would like file things, and then that all went away, and NARA still exists. But it's kind of like, if you send something to NARA, you may never, I mean, you can ask for it back, and in a few weeks they'll send it to you, but you don't have it like right at hand if you need that
information. NARA is the National
Archives and Records Administration. Mm-hmm. So it's always kind of tense, and the Park Service is not on top of its records, and probably won't be for a long time if it ever is, because I was at a meeting last week with, and the Joy Beasley, who's the associate director for cultural resources right now, you know, I asked her about it because she just, it was like a regional cultural resources get together kind of thing. And I was like, you know, am I just crazy, or are the records, you know, like, is records management an issue in the Park Service? And she's like, no, this is a huge issue and you're not crazy and we don't know how to deal with it. And we're still struggling with that. Right. So that's
and,
it, you know.
And that's in terms of keeping track of the park's own administrative internal history and their own records and papers. But Klondike, you have all those photographs and there's diaries and letters and things as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how are those managed?
Well, they're managed as part of the park archives.
And oral history recordings, you guys, they have those.
Those are also managed as part of the park archives. And there was some, you know, some work with Carl on that because it was all in the library, and the Stampeder files, I was able to talk him into migrating those into the archives because parts of the Stampeder files kind of were like missing or went away. We were, you know, and so we did 100% inventory of them as we migrated them over, and we're like, yeah, there's some that are not here anymore. So I feel good about that, that we were able to put that in the archives and have it in a secure location. And part of that was that we digitized all of those, you know, and so they're still accessible.
And what are those files?
Oh, so the Stampeder files are people. So Carl had a form. If you had an ancestor that was in the Klondike Gold Rush, that you could, it was basically just looking for genealogical information. And then there's part on the form of like, do you have anything that you would like to send us, like copies of letters or, mm-hmm. you know, collections or whatever. And so those files mostly don't have anything original in them, but they have copies of, so it's good information. And I think there was like 1,000 of them, I think, when I left there. So that's a lot of just first person primary source kind of history from, mm-hmm. you know, Stampeder's. Sometimes it was somebody had given their family an oral history and a family member had typed it up. And sometimes it was copies of letters. And sometimes it was, hey, I remember my grandfather telling me this story. And so it was kind of like a wide variety of material.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned digitization. How much digitization was done in the time you were there, if any?
No, I definitely... So I recall that we digitized all the Stampeder files when we pulled them over. And I also had interns or volunteers working on, I think we just redigitized all of the historical photographs, as I recall, because it was really kind of piecemeal and then they weren't standards. You know, it's like, so I'm going to probably do that here too, because it's like early digitization, like it's kind of like, a lot of times a low image quality, or maybe it's not like 100% of the collection. And so I think we, as I recall, we went through and just did every historical photograph.
That's a lot of photographs.
You know what? And actually, I don't really think it was.
Oh, really?
I mean, well, I'm about to have two interns come in and digitize like 5,000 aerial photographs and then a whole bunch of slides. So what I thought was maybe a lot of historical photographs at the time, now that I'm doing resource management records and the amount of information that can be generated in like by like one aerial flight,
yeah,
it really puts a perspective on it. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you mentioned public access to the objects. What about to the archival collections?
Well, you know, the archives are always available to whoever wanted to come and look at things, and we did have some researchers that came. And we did sometimes have requests for the Stampeder files. A lot more of the requests usually came from interpreters that were developing their tours. We had a lot of requests for historical photographs, and that was one reason why that collection became a priority.
Mm-hmm.
And that definitely was something that I started to really specialize in while I was there, is just, you know, understanding, managing historical photographs. I taught a workshop a couple times about just for people in the community if they had, you know, photographs that they wanted to, that they had at home and they wanted to preserve. So, yeah, we regularly got reference requests for those. And that was, so what we did was we digitized them to TIFF uncompressed, and then we put a JPEG on, and then there's a web catalog. So we made that available on the web catalog, you know, and that was where it was actually handy that every historical photograph was actually individually cataloged. And as I recall, we also put that all on the park server as well, so that interpreters and stuff, people could, park staff could easily access those.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing with a collection, is how it's cataloged so you can go back and find, like, oh, I want a picture of,
right,
you know, a horse pulling a wagon. Like,
right. So the metadata or the cataloging information is always really important, because how do you sort for, you know, and there was one, so Margaret, gosh, I can't remember her last name, but she was a volunteer who came. She started coming when Debbie Sanders was there, and she kept coming. She was in her 80s and would show up, and she had cataloged a lot of these photographs, and she would often put dog-eared. And so anytime you, like, if you were searching on dog, you would come up with all of these images that all that had dog-eared in their description. So, you know, there are pitfalls there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you have to know what terms to use.
Right. Right. So that's one of the things that you learn along the way, is that it's better to have some kind of structured lexicon for your description. And we never did. We talked about it a lot, but we didn't really. Mostly, I think, because that everything had been cataloged already. So we weren't really going to, we didn't have time to go back and recatalog or anything like that. It was mostly about, like, digitizing it so that there was consistency, and then we could put it up on the web catalog and have it available to people.
So while you were there working on the Rapuzzi collection, did it get finished? Catalog, accession catalog while you were there?
We got to the point where definitely not everything was cataloged. We finished the processing, and what I mean by that is that we had, Judy and I had gone through, we'd gone through the selection process, and we come out the other side with, these things have been transferred to the park, these things are in the city collection, and then we have this other batch of material that we need to figure out where it's going. And that was difficult, because then it's, that was where things got really hard for Judy, because all of it was city property, and there was a new city manager, as I recall, who, you know, so there's all these ethics in the museum world about how do you dispose of property, how do you deaccession. Mm-hmm. Technically, none of it needed to be deaccessioned, because that
group hadn't been accessioned.
So it was technically city property. But then there's also, you know, the Rasmussen Foundation is really powerful in Alaska, and part of how Teresa was able to leverage purchasing this collection is that she had a buddy who was the head of the Rasmussen Foundation, who also really wanted to see the streetcar run in the 4th of July parade, so that was part of the heat there. And then, you know, it's kind of like, okay, well, you guys gave us all this money to buy all this stuff, and now we're going to auction it off, you know? And so that doesn't look very good. And so that was kind of a weird situation to be in. And so there was a lot of, there was supposed to be, we had a committee where we discussed different options about what that process was going to be. And I don't know where it is now. I don't know what happened, but there was some discussion about having an auctioneer or having it, you know. I mean, definitely there was sort of an idea like the city should get some money for some things, but then it's kind of like, well, and then if nobody wants it, do we just take it to the dump? Like, what do we do with it then, you know? Right. And
so what's standard museum practice on something like that? Well, you just take things to the dump?
In the Park Service, there are, yeah, you can deaccession something and destroy it. You can transfer it to another museum. And I did a lot of, I did some of that, reaching out to different, we photographed a bunch of stuff, as I recall. And then, actually, Carrie Rain did a lot of that. She runs the Wilderness Center now. She's a trail ranger. And in the summer, in the winters, when she was, because she's seasonally employed, she would, I picked her up for some pay periods to do some, she photographed actually quite a few objects for us, as I recall. So I sent out, and so we were kind of like, okay, what are the steps that need to happen? And offering it to other museums is definitely one of those steps. Mm-hmm. So I sent out CDs to other museums in Alaska with pictures and, you know, spreadsheets of stuff to see if anybody wanted anything. And the Hammer Museum came over from Haines, mm-hmm. and took some things, which was kind of really, really fun, yeah. Actually. Yeah, those guys are cool.
It's a fun little museum.
It's one of my favorite in the whole world.
Yeah.
It's really, I love the Hammer Museum. So that was really cool having those guys over. And yeah, so yeah, I mean, you can transfer to another museum, or you can destroy it, or you can, I mean, it's very controversial to sell something that you're deaccessioning. Usually that's like in the art world though, or, you know, but there was a period where museums were balancing their budgets by selling off artwork, and
right.
That's definitely frowned on. But I don't really think that this material is in that same category, because it's like broken chairs and stuff.
Right. So it's still sitting in a warehouse? The stuff that wasn't acquired by the park and the city is just sitting in a warehouse somewhere in Skagway still?
Well, it was when I left. I don't know what's mm-hmm. happened in the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, you were saying, you know, all these things you did while you were able to hire so-and-so for a while, you interned. It seemed like you were able to get a lot of funding for the collections. Is that typical in a park?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to toot my own horn, but I'm pretty good at working things out. And I mean, some of that funding was already formulated before I ever got there,
right.
Like the conservation stuff.
Right.
Sometimes it was like, hey, we got a little bit, hey, you know, do you think you guys could spare, you know, $7,000 and pay Rain for 4 pay periods to photograph stuff? I mean, I don't know, like, you just kind of find money
mm-hmm.
places.
Well, and I was wondering if, because Klondike, you know, you said the collections are so much a part of that park.
They're very high profile.
They're very high profile, and that the leadership and administration is more willing to listen to those things and say, oh yeah, yeah, here, we'll find you some money.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that museum collection was very high profile.
Now, but you did also have, there is a natural resources component of their program. Did you have to fight within resources for pots of money?
No, I never did. I'm trying to think about how, I mean, like with park housing, that was always usually pretty easy to absorb into our budget. And then I think we just kind of put in budget requests. And I mean, I'm not trying to say in any way that I think that the natural resources program there was well supported, because for most of the time I was there, there wasn't anybody even in that position.
Okay.
Right. So it just, I mean, I think one thing is I tend to make reasonable requests. And then, you know, some of it was like, well, okay, if we're going to, like, for example, with the Alaskom, I think the reason I was probably able to get money for Rain to photograph objects is probably because we were going to move out of that building, and there were things that we needed to do. And then also, okay, well, if we're not going to be in that building anymore, we're going to save a certain amount of money. So I can have some, can I have some of that money? You know, and things like that. I mean, I don't really remember how that worked out exactly, but it just sort of always seemed to, and you know, I don't usually ask for a lot. And I usually, when I ask for it, I have a reason.
Mm-hmm. So but you felt like overall the collection program was well enough funded?
I did. I will say, though, that when I left, they switched my position to subject to furlough, and I found that shocking because there was so much work to do all the time that there is no way that that position should be subject to furlough. And when Deb was, you know, she was term the whole time that I was there, and then that position was advertised as permanent. So in a way, yes, and in a way, no. Because, like, for example, you know, when we received the Rapuzzi collection, there was a base funding increase to cover not just one, but I think two museum technicians. And that should have immediately turned into a permanent position. But it never did. And Deb stayed on a term appointment. We were able to get her a second term appointment, which you can't even do anymore. I was really lucky that I kind of got on the tail end of that. And then that was running up. And so then it was decided that, okay, well, we can have a permanent museum technician. But they made it subject to furlough. And it was like, you guys, like, you know, I mean, there's so much work that needs to be done. And before, when she was a term, you were able to, like, keep her completely funded all the time. But now suddenly you don't need her all the time. Like, you know, whatever. I mean, so.
Well, was it because, oh, we got this big collection coming in, the Rapuzzi one, we got to deal with it. And now they think there's not as much work to do? Because that's sort of been finished, quote-unquote finished.
I don't even think it had anything to do with that. It probably had to do with other things, like the park perceiving more of a need in some other area or not being able to balance their budget or whatever, you know. I mean, it's like, yeah, that's just a thing that happens in the Park Service. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily depend on whether the perceived need of workflow, you know. Park administrators often don't make their decision based, because everybody will say, I'm totally overworked, there's so much to do, right. And they're all right. So I think they've just gotten hardened shells and they make their decisions based on other things.
Well, as you say, like, oh, well, we need to put money into the natural resources program for a while, so we're not going to fund the curatorial as much, or there's some, you know, crisis management that has to happen or whatever.
Well, I think what might be very likely is that they were like, well, now we've got to have an interpreter completely dedicated to letting people in and out of Jeff Smith's parlor. So you're going to have to give us some money so we can do that.
Right.
That's not out of the realm of the possibility.
Right. Or now we're going to restore this building and we need a little bit more. But that's different.
The building comes from fund sources. Yeah. The OMPS is what's paying those permanent salaries. So, and seasonal salaries. Yeah.
Well, and I was wondering, you know, the Rapuzzi collection was so huge. Did that come with any funding to process it? Because the Rasmussen helped purchase it.
Yeah.
So did they also provide?
Oh, no.
No.
No. But there was an increase to the base funding that was supposed to pay for
the park
museum
did recognize that they needed to step it up a bit.
Yeah, and it did, but they didn't commit to a permanent position for it. Even though any museum person is going to tell you, like, well, once you have it, you're going to have to take care of it forever. And I mean, they did, you know, we did, I mean, Deb was funded off of base accounts, but they didn't ever commit to, you know. So, no, there was no funding that came from the Rapuzzi collection for processing it. That was all just purchasing it.
And then
there's a lot of expectations about what's supposed to happen there.
And is that typical? Collections come in without funding?
Oh, yeah. It happens to me all the time. Mostly, though, what I receive is collections that are, you know, mostly I receive collections that are generated from the park here.
Right.
But no, I think generally it's not, you don't really generally consider that to be a thing. You know, the Rasmussen Foundation is not in the business of funding park personnel.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
during your tenure in Skagway, were there other collections that came in besides Rapuzzi, other interesting things you worked on, or were you 100% focused on Rapuzzi?
There were small things that came in, and there's always mandated collections, like archaeology stuff comes in every year. There was a collection of bottles that we received from Alvin Gordon, where his dog bit me when I went over to get them. So
I was going to say, risk management.
I know. Yeah, that was kind of a thing. So, I mean, I felt really bad. Well, yeah, it was funny because I came back to the office and Deb was like, yeah, that dog's really bitey. And I was like, really? You couldn't have told me before I went over there? Because I just walked, reamed down and was like, hey, puppy. You know, and he was like, bit my hand. I mean, it wasn't terrible, but it was just kind of like, oh. But yeah, he and his wife had been, they would go to the Yukon and dig up bottles, basically, which is not anything that we want to encourage in any way, but he's really sweet, she's really sweet, and his kids didn't want the bottles and what was going to happen to the bottles, so we took them on thinking that you know, we could use them for displays in the front and things mm-hmm. like that, you know, because it's like there's so many buildings and there's so many windows, and the park has a big bottle collection anyway. So
did people, tourists or other visitors, come and just knock on your door, say, hey, I found this in my grandfather's attic, do you want it?
Not generally, no. I mean, there are collections that have come in that way. There's a cool collection that we received kind of like that. I mean, it was a little bit more arranged than that, but it was like, and I think we maybe ended up using, this is one that we recommended that the exhibit designers use in the visitor center. It was because it was like, we had his trunk, and that had, like, people had signed, you know, like when he was getting on, ready to leave to go to the Klondike, and we had his gun, his rifle, and we had a necklace made out of some gold that he'd collected that he'd given to his wife, and there was a couple of postcards written on birch bark.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a cool little collection that came in before I started working there. I think Deb actually processed it in between when Deb Sanders left and before I showed up.
Do you remember the name of that collection?
I don't. She would know.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about things from the Chilkoot Trail or the White Pass Trail? Did people bring things in?
No, not at that point. I mean, you know, by the time I was there, there was not very, you know, it was interesting. Like, the first time I hiked out on the Chilkoot Trail, I expected to see all this material everywhere. And there just really wasn't that much. The forest, I think, well, I mean, it's possible that people picked things up, but the forest also had swallowed up a lot of stuff by then, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I've heard stories in the, you know, the old days, just like George Rapuzzi would go mm-hmm. into the old buildings. Anybody who hiked the trail would pick up something and take it home with them.
Yeah. And I think probably things got sent back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really recall any instances particularly.
But there was stuff in the collection that had happened. People sent things. I mean, that collection must have a lot of things that used to be out on the trail. No?
Not necessarily. There was kind of a whole thing where there was a... So early on in the park's history, there was a time when they were starting to accession and catalog things out on the trail. And mm-hmm. then Debbie Sanders put the kibosh on that and was like, you can't catalog something that's not... Like, there's a certain level of control you have to have for museum collections, right? Like, you need to actually... The idea is that you're pulling them out of the stream of time. So having something that's, like, sitting out on the ground and unsecured and is just disintegrating, like, don't have that in the collection. So there was a bunch of stuff she deaccessioned then.
So they accessioned it and mm-hmm. put a number on it out there
right.
on the trail?
Yeah.
And just left it out there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then there were several... projects to, like, you know, locate and kind of survey objects. We had records for that. None of that happened when I was there. But that, I mean, like I say, by the time I was there, there really wasn't that much stuff left out there. So, I mean, I'm sure that there definitely is stuff that, but, you know, the thing is that, like, if it's off the trail, I mean, there's, like, all the land ownership issues there. Mm-hmm. So if it's not directly on the trail, like we, the Park Service really only owns like a narrow corridor of that trail. And so then it's State of Alaska stuff. And then it gets more complicated. And that was always an issue because we didn't have a memorandum of agreement with them, but there was stuff that we had in the collection that we were pretty sure was off of State of Alaska land, or people would bring stuff. What people would bring stuff from is the Bark Canada, because then when there's low tide, that shipwreck is available.
Out in Dyea.
And yeah, and then I know that was a thing when I was there, because people were like, this is just disintegrating in place. And it's kind of like, yeah, it's a shipwreck. It's going to do that, you know? And so there was definitely some stuff that was brought in, I think. And it's kind of like, hey, don't do that. You know, we don't own that. We can't take it on necessarily. And yeah, I mean, I know that the stuff that was in the, so I know some of the things that were from the Chilkoot Trail in the collection, if I think about it, is like, we had some of those wooden boat bundles. There's like a stash of them kind of near the summit.
Hmm.
And so we had a few of those that had been brought in, and there was definitely some, you know, kind of like the things that were on display. But I think that, I mean, generally the idea was to leave things in place.
Yeah. And I think over the years they did surveys and inventories to say what was out there, and then now what's still there. And so it's still being kept track of, but just not in a museum way.
Right, which is, yeah, that would be appropriate, because it should not be, none of that stuff, if it's out there in the weather, should be museum property.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there something that you can look back on and say you're the most proud of that you succeeded at doing during your tenure up there? Something you accomplished?
Well, I feel really good about the intern programs that I facilitated, you know, having those conservation interns. I mean, I feel really good about Jeff Smith's Parlor Museum. I mean, that I spent my whole time there working on that project, and so it was really gratifying to be able to install it and see all that stuff come to fruition. And honestly, like, you know, that every project was a partnership project. That was, I loved working with the maintenance crew and working with them on the buildings and building those relationships and getting everybody involved and having them all feel like they were invested. That was really fun. So, and yeah, just gratifying that it was about that we were all managing this resource together, and everybody was a part of that. So that I think is probably the thing that I really, really liked about working there.
Something that was particularly challenging or an obstacle you had to overcome?
It was a very challenging workload. And I mean, you know, the things that I've spoke about, you know, in terms of negotiating all of those relationships, I mean, those were, so it was kind of like there's a batch of relationships that was really stressful to negotiate, like with Teresa. And I really enjoyed working with Judy, but she was under a lot of pressures, and sometimes, you know, that was, she was coming from a different place and thinking about her institution and what she was going to be responsible for. And so those things were, you know, and then working with the superintendent, those things were always really stressful. And so what balanced that was getting to work with, you know, like the maintenance crew and Deb and these interns and like kind of the not head honchos, you know, and getting to like go out and actually get something done instead of being in meetings talking about getting something done.
When do you feel like you were listened to, that you had a say in things when you were talking with the superintendent or in those decision or with Teresa in those decision-making processes?
I felt that I was respected, that my viewpoint was going to be heard. It wasn't always going to be agreed with or acted on, but that I had, I definitely had a lot to bring to the table. So I didn't feel, you know, I mean, initially it was rough, but by the time I left, I was definitely, you know, an influencer or whatever, you know, that I was somebody that people were listening to when we were talking about that stuff.
And that being in the fishbowl and that being so stressful, that is unusual for a curatorial position? Or is that typical?
I would say neither. I mean, it just sort of depends on your park and how high profile your collection is. Like here, I'm definitely not in the fishbowl at the museum collection. I have to struggle to make it relevant. And so that's a different kind of challenge. It was never any question when I was in Skagway about whether the museum collection was relevant. And I think, honestly, you know, in a historical park, you would expect the museum collection to be front and center,
right?
You know, so it just sort of, it depends. It's every different park is different.
Yeah. But it does sound stressful.
Thanks for me.
Yeah. Well, I was also wondering if it was sort of like, because you were there with the whole Rapuzzi thing and it was this big collection and all this stuff in motion, if it was extra pressure and stress on you than a curator in a different time.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, I think it was a lot of pressure on Debbie Sanders, you know, because they started that whole process. I mean, I was fortunate that I kind of came in the middle and they had already established how they were going to do things, you mm-hmm. know. But definitely in terms of dealing with a historical collection, that was a very unique situation because you have this massive material, you have a bunch of politics involved with it, and then you have a bunch of material in the collection that you know you aren't going to want, and that makes it really complicated. And then you have this partnership, you know, and did I mention all the politics around that in like small town Alaska? But not just small town Alaska, it's like the Rasmussen Foundation, so it's like, but then Alaska kind of feels like a big small town, like,
right.
You know, that everybody knows everybody and what's going on. And then you also have the layers of Park Service professional standards. So when the regional curator comes in and looks at what's happening, she's got a whole different set of concerns than what the Rasmussen Foundation lady says. And then like Judy having to cope with the city council. And that, I think, is particularly hard because they don't know any, you know, at least in the Park Service, we're in the business of, you know, historic preservation, but the city council is not. I mean, they're thinking about, like, most of the people on the city council own some kind of tourist business, and so they're very much capitalists, and they're not really thinking about the public good of historic preservation. They're, like, just operating on a whole different level. And so, I mean, I know that she has kind of like an advisory board and that they were helpful, but I heard a lot of criticism of her when I was there that I sort of thought was not seeing the whole situation, and that she had never asked to be in that situation, and that it was kind of thrust on her. And I think that was, I think she got the short end of the shaft in that mm-hmm. whole thing. I really do. So,
well, I was thinking just you and your position that you pulled by all those different players, as you said, you know, you have the Park Service that you're reporting to who has certain standards or a certain bureaucracy too. There are things you had to do a certain way. Like
right.
You couldn't just go out and buy things.
Right.
And then the city and then Rasmussen, that how you negotiate all that to feel like you have any decision-making power.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is that you can always kind of go back on, well, this is the Park Service standard and this is what the policy says. That was really helpful. Whereas if you're in, you know, Judy's situation and you have the standalone city museum, you can, all you can say is, well, the best practices in the field are, you know, like you don't have, like, it was very helpful to have the structure of Park Service policy to kind of be like, we don't do it that way, we do it this way, you know, so that, yeah.
Were there times that being part of the Park Service bureaucracy were a hindrance?
Not for me. I mean, I feel I'm pretty good with bureaucracy. It's kind of fine. You know, I mean, it's like when you can figure out what the pathways are and negotiate them, I really was fine with it. Well, you know what you're getting into. It's like I thought it was okay.
Well, I just can't imagine organizing and cataloging such a huge collection. Like, how do you even know where to start?
You start with the first thing in front of you, you know? You just go one at a time, and you just keep doing. I mean, Deb has cataloged tens of thousands of objects, and it's like, and it takes a certain personality. Like, there's a certain detail-oriented personality that really just likes doing that and finds it very relaxing, because you aren't thinking about, you know, oh God, you know, the last polar bear is dying or whatever.
Right.
You're just like, I'm just cataloging. It's all, you know. And we had a very cozy office. Like, we'd listen to KHNS, have that on the radio, and be puttering along on, you know, what we were doing.
So were you doing some of the cataloging too, or?
I did some. I did, I mean, not as much as I would have liked to. I did a very little bit. I did spend a lot of time, I would spend time rehousing things, because one of the benefits of having Scott Carley come is that he taught us how to make housings and for artifacts, and
it's
so
like the acid-free boxes and the
little inert foam bumpers and stuff like that. And I spent some time. I really enjoy doing that. It's very relaxing, and so it's kind of like arts and crafts stuff. And so I would tend to do that, and then Deb did probably more of the cataloging. I had her working on archives a lot when I was there, part of the reason that she had to work on archives is that was how we were able to work out her second term, is that we advertised it as an archives technician rather than a museum technician. So she was doing a lot of archives partly because of that.
And so you were doing a lot more of the management, going to meetings, planning.
Oh, most of my job budget. Was being the program manager. It was nice when I had time to go and actually spend working hands-on with the collection. That was always a pleasure. You know, I'd get to do that in the winter sometimes, but mm-hmm. like I was definitely a program manager, and that was one of the reasons that I liked this job that I have now, is that I spend most of my time hands-on with the collection, and it's completely opposite of what it was in Klondike.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there certain, you mentioned the horse skull, but are other things that stand out to you as favorites in the Klondike collections, whether it's photos or objects? Or...
Mm. There's a candy mold that they actually ended up making candy out of.
Really?
After I left.
You're allowed to do that?
I kind of don't think they really probably should have done that, but it was sort of cool that they did it. I probably would not have had the guts to send it out to do that, but it was kind of cool that that happened. They sent me a bag of candy. But the candy mold itself was this beautiful brass. I love shiny brass stuff. And the mannequins I actually became very good friends with, so I was kind of fond of them. And that big moose mount, that double moose mount. My favorite part about that taxidermy is these two little ermine that have like these crazy, crazy faces. And I still have a picture of them on my desktop slideshow because they were totally like, they're just nuts looking. And they're just, you know, a lot of the George or the Martinich and stuff is just so wacky that it's just, I liked working with the stuff that came from him because you could see that there was this really creative brain that was just kind of, you know, making found object art, really. Mm-hmm. So that was fun to see that. So
why did you decide to leave the job in Skagway?
I really missed Puget Sound. I lived in Seattle for 15 years, and I loved being here. I had a community. I'm queer, and I had a queer family, you know, a made family here, or chosen family. And I just really missed them, and I missed being in this place. And when North Cascades opened up, you know, I came down and looked, because I had moved to Skagway sight unseen, and I didn't want to do that again because I knew wherever I was going to be, I was going to be there probably, you know, right now I plan on living here the rest of my life, and I wanted that. Some people in the Park Service will move from park to park really mm-hmm. easily. I'm not that kind of person. I really wanted to buy a house and just be somewhere. And my partner is 20 years older than I am. And so that was really, I think, the pushing factor was he, you know, his health is not great. And we were having very poor experiences with the hospital in Juneau. And I really wanted to get him back down to the 48 where we could have better health, you know, health care for him. So that was big. And I was ready to own a house, and I would never have been able to afford a house in Skagway, and it didn't seem like a long-term plan. So I just started keeping my eyes open, and there really are only a few parks that I really wanted to move to, so I was just lucky that North Cascades opened up when it did. And so I came down here, and my supervisor, Kim, I introduced myself to her and was basically like, you know, I'd really like to work here. And then when I was here on that trip, I also looked at houses and tried to figure out, like, you know, is this a place I could afford to buy a house? And that all just worked out. And it's, the park is so beautiful that I just really, you know, it's funny because in Skagway, one of the things I loved about Skagway is that there's so much wildlife. You know, there's seals and there's all these birds every year. And I thought, wow, there's so much wildlife here. And it's like, that's got nothing on the Pacific Northwest rainforest. Like, there is so much wildlife here. And I mean, I miss the seals and I miss being close to the salt water, but this is good. I have rainforest now instead, so.
Looking back at your time in Skagway, are there things you wished you could have accomplished that you weren't able to?
I don't feel that way. I kind of wish that I would have seen, it would have been nice to see that visitor center exhibit get installed, just because I was in part of the process and then didn't get to see the end of it. It was really gratifying to be part of installing Jessma's Parlor and get to see that project come to fruition. Mm-hmm. Like, I really enjoyed that. But you know, it's, with curation, it's like you just plug into a workflow and you don't really, it's nice if you can ever see a project get finished, but the projects take so long. And there's such a, you know, you just kind of show up to work every day and you get done what you can get done. So,
yeah, so in curatorial, yeah, there isn't, there often is not, oh, we cataloged this whole collection, we're done.
Yeah.
We rehoused it, we're done. That doesn't happen so much.
Well, I mean, every once in a while. But with that, I mean, with the Rapuzzi collection stuff, I knew I would never see it completed, whatever that means. And, right. You know, you're always trying to figure out, you know, is there a, you know, like an interpretive product you can make out of this, or can we digitize this and make it more accessible? Like, there aren't very many things that I think of as, okay, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And also with museum collections, you have to go back in, I don't know if you could do it every year or periodically, to check the material and condition reports and all those kinds of things.
Oh, I mean, condition reporting is not something that happens very often, honestly.
Really?
I mean there are cycles set up in the you know, museum database for, oh, you're, you know, oh, this is something that should be looked at every 2 years, but honestly that's probably not really gonna happen. I think that Stephanie Stevens had recommended doing 100% inventory of the collection, and I think that would be really smart, like, now that the processing for the Rapuzzi collection is done. I think 100% inventory there would be, you know, because I know there were things, and this is my fault, things that Deb couldn't find, and it was probably because I'd been on rehousing something and then moved it and not made the note in the right location or whatever. But some of the systems at Klondike were not very efficient, and so it was like, if you moved an object, you'd have to like change a location in this database and that database and that database, and that just became, you know, I will be the first to say that I'm not as good at that kind of documentation as Deb is, and so I know that was probably frustrating for her.
So did you ever make an attempt to change those systems to be more efficient?
Not for the Rapuzzi stuff, because my thought was like, well, at some point this will be cataloged and then we will track it. And you know, once it's cataloged, you just track it in ICMS. And I think that was where things got confusing sometimes, is that was my attitude, is like, all these other databases are temporary and ICMS is the final database. So if it has the correct location in ICMS, we don't have to worry about anything else. But for Deb, I think her attitude was more like, oh, all of these other databases are alive and we need to update this and everything else. That is probably where things went wrong. So.
And what does ICMS stand for?
Interior Collection Management System. And that's the museum database that's used by the whole Department of Interior.
Okay. Yeah, so that inefficiency of the system, it's still kind of there.
I mean, I haven't been there for 3 years, right. But maybe.
Yeah.
Probably.
Well, it's a lot of material to keep track of.
Yeah. So the thing would be to get it all cataloged, and then you would have, then it would be an ICMS, and it would be part of the random sample inventory, and you would have it all cataloged, and ideally you would have a photograph that you could make part of the web catalog, and so people could then see it. mm-hmm. you know, that would be a good goal.
And so the idea is, if, like you say, like if you rehouse something and you moved it, you have to go back to the computer and say, this is now on shelf such and such in row whatever.
Yeah, and like I think it was all in an Access database, but I think you could also argue that maybe the thing to put in Access database is cataloged in ICMS, CICMS for location.
Right, but that's yeah. But what I'm saying is that yeah. with the collection, it's the inventory includes where it is physically located
yes.
on a shelf, like a library book or something.
Yes.
So if it changes location,
right.
you need to indicate that or nobody will ever find it again.
Right. And that might be a good reason to do 100% inventory, is to make sure that all those things are updated and you really know. Or you could also argue that that energy might be better spent by just cataloging as much of everything as you possibly can, so that you actually have things cataloged.
Well, that's the thing. Is the collection all cataloged?
Oh, no, not by a long shot. There's no way. I mean, I've been gone for 3.5 years, but there was so much material. There's no way that it's all cataloged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that it sounds overwhelming.
One object at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there are other things that you had in mind you wanted to talk about when I brought up this idea of doing an interview?
No, I feel like this was very thorough, and honestly, I'm kind of running out of
okay.
words.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.